Lecture 10. When and where did Abraham live?
This lecture addresses the two questions announced in the title. When did Abraham live, and where is Ur the birthplace of Abraham? There is considerable scholarly debate concerning both of these issues. The dates proposed for Abraham range from circa 2000 BCE to circa 1400 BCE. As I indicated earlier, I adhere to the latest possible date, 1400. We'll talk about the earlier date, however, stretching back to 2000 as well. Scholars also debate the location of Ur, the birthplace of Abraham. Is it to be identified with the great Sumerian city in southern Mesopotamia? Or is it to be located in another city with the same name in northern Mesopotamia? In this case, I adhere to the latter opinion. The different arguments for the various opinions will be surveyed in this lecture, and the reasons for our conclusions in favor of the later date, 1400 BCE, and a northern Ur to be identified with Urfa in modern-day southern Turkey will be presented. This lecture also will discuss two cities from the ancient world, the city of Nuzi in modern-day northern Iraq, whose archives have provided social and economic parallels to the Book of Genesis, and the city of Ugarit in northwestern Syria on the Mediterranean coast, whose literature provides an important thematic parallel to the story of Abraham. Let's turn now to the first of the questions we seek to answer. When did Abraham live? By asking this question at all, one clearly is approaching the subject from the maximalist standpoint. You'll recall the division that we referred to earlier among scholars between maximalists and minimalists. The minimalists, who don't see Abraham as a historical figure, would not even bother to ask this question. The maximalists, however, deal with this issue: when did Abraham live? A standard view places Abraham as early as 2000 BCE. How do scholars arrive at this dating? Now, this dating is based mainly on a literal acceptance of the number of years presented in the biblical text. Let me explain. We begin with our starting point, or as our starting point, with the date of the Exodus. Now, there is a general scholarly consensus that the Exodus from Egypt occurred in approximately 1200 BCE, perhaps 25 years before that, maybe 50 years before that, maybe 25 years after that date, but more or less 1200 BCE. And that's something that almost all scholars agree upon. Now, in the book of Exodus, chapter 12, we are told that the Israelites lived in Egypt for 430 years. That would take us back to 1630 BCE, or perhaps 1650 BCE, for the time of the entry of the Israelites into the land of Egypt, that is to say, the story of Joseph and his brothers at the end of the book of Genesis. Incidentally, there is a statement in Genesis chapter 15 where God tells Abraham that his descendants would be living in a land not their own as slaves for 400 years. How do we dovetail the 400-year statement in Genesis 15 with the 430-year statement in Exodus 12? The answer seems to be that the statement in Exodus 12 refers to the entire period of the Israelites resident in Egypt, 430 years, whereas the statement in Genesis 15 talks about only the 400 years of slavery. The implication being that for 30 years, the Israelites lived as free and prosperous individuals in Egypt, and that again would be consistent with the story of Joseph and his brothers. The Pharaoh under whom Joseph served looked kindly upon the Israelites. 30 years and then 400 years of slavery for a total of 430 years of the Israelites living in Egypt. And so this gives us a date again of 1630 or 1650 BCE, perhaps even earlier, 1700, for the time of Joseph. You then work back with Jacob, Isaac, and Abraham, and you get close to the year 2000 BCE. But this, of course, takes somewhat of a literal approach to the number of years that these individuals lived. And the years of the three patriarchs is far beyond the norms of any human lifespan. Abraham, we are told, lived to be 175, Isaac 180, and Jacob 147. And that totals up to more than 400 years. Clearly, they overlapped to some extent, and so the lifespans of these three individuals is somehow seen to be about 300 years or so, and that gets us back from Joseph in the 17th century to Abraham in the 20th century BCE, or perhaps as early as 2000 BCE. That'll give you some indication as to how scholars figure out the date of Abraham and arrive at the year 2000 BCE. There's a problem with this approach, however, to my mind, and that is it accepts these numbers all too literally. These numbers are not to be taken in literal fashion. They are instead to be seen as idealized numbers. Now let's talk about the number of years that appear in the Bible. In the earlier parts of the Bible, the books of Genesis and Exodus that we're talking about, down through the time of David and Solomon, on the one hand, and the years that appear, especially in the book of Kings and the latter books of the Bible, such as the book of Chronicles and the book of Esther, which are from the time of Solomon onward, the monarchic period and the exilic and post-exilic periods. Now, there's a difference between these two sets of figures that appear in the earlier material and the later material. And this, they are, the difference is as follows. In the earlier books, there is no strict counting of years. There is an epic tradition in the biblical narrative. I have not given you this equation yet. Let me give it to you now. Biblical narrative is comprised of history plus epic. There's a historical tale that is being told, as we've discussed, and there's an epic overlay to it. And the number of years that appear in these stories, and some of the other grossly exaggerated numbers, such as the 600,000 Israelites who left Egypt, adult males that is, this is part of the epic storytelling tradition. This style of writing came to an end in Israel with the arrival of the monarchy. And that's because with the arrival of the monarchy, you have a new type of writer who is writing texts, and that is the royal scribe keeping royal annals in the palace. And these become much more accurate in their presentation of the years, because the annalistic style of writing keeps track of years more accurately than the epic style of writing. So the introduction of the monarchy, under David and Solomon in particular, brought with it royal scribes, and in fact, in the book of Samuel, in the book of Kings, we have the names and the titles of these individuals, scribes, recorders, and so on, who clearly were keeping track of the years of the monarchs. Therefore, from Solomon onward, we get exact dating. When we talk about the destruction of Judah in 586 BCE, or the destruction of Israel in 721 BCE by the hands of the Babylonians and Assyrians respectively, we are able to fix these events to specific years or debate perhaps one-year differences so that, yes, some scholars may say 587 instead of 586 or 722 instead of 721. But that's as far as the debate goes because we have such accurate records being kept by the biblical scribes, or I should say by the royal scribes, in Jerusalem in the south, Samaria, the capital of Israel, in the north, and of course by the Assyrian and Babylonian royal scribes in Mesopotamia as well. But that's not true of the earlier biblical material, as I indicated. Therefore, one sees the same numbers repeating over and over again, especially the number 40. The flood lasts 40 days and 40 nights. Moses is on top of Mount Sinai 40 days and 40 nights. The Israelites wander in the desert for 40 years. When we reach the book of Judges, events or spans of time take place over the course of 40 years, or sometimes twice that number, 80 years, and sometimes half that number, 20 years. The reign of David is 40 years, and the reign of Solomon is 40 years. Now, I indicated that under David and Solomon, you already have royal scribes coming into place in the palace, and that's true, but the accurate kind of record-keeping for the years of the king seems to have taken place only with the arrival of the divided kingdom. Under David and Solomon, you have the end of the epic tradition, and so we can see with those two kings a bit of the transitionary period where they're still talking about 40 years this and 40 years that. These things can't possibly always happen in multiples of 40, and notice that the period of time that the Israelites lived in Egypt, or were enslaved in Egypt, I should say, according to Genesis 15, is also 400 years, that is 10 times 40. These are, to repeat, idealized numbers, and they should not be taken literally. Instead, we can use other information that the Bible provides for us to try to fix the date of Abraham, and that is the genealogical material. The peoples of the ancient world and traditional people in the Near East to this day keep very accurate genealogies. They are able to tell you, at least on their father's father's line, the lineage going back 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 generations, and they transmit this material accurately, again, especially on the main patrilineal line. Now, if we look in the Bible, we see something quite fascinating. We see an internal consistency with all the genealogical material that's presented. Furthermore, if we look at the books of the Torah from Exodus through Numbers, we see a number of characters mentioned there who are, in their genealogies, 3 or 4 generations removed from the sons of Jacob who entered Egypt. Let's give the best example, the best and most well-known example, is Moses and his brother Aaron and his sister Miriam. They are the children of Amram. Amram is the son of Kohath, and Kohath is the son of Levi. Levi is one of Joseph's brothers among the sons of Jacob. That is to say, Levi must have been, along with Joseph and the other brothers, among those Israelites who went to Egypt and lived there freely and prospered under the Pharaoh under whom Joseph served. And it was his son Kohath who must have been the first to experience the slavery. And his son Amram clearly was involved at this period as well. And it was his children, Moses and Aaron and Miriam, who were the leaders of the Israelites as they left Egypt. Even if we assume that Moses and Aaron and Miriam as leaders were already advanced in age to some extent, then they would have had a younger generation who would have been leaving Egypt as well. And that's why we say 3 or 4 generations of Israelites is all there was during the entire period of the going down to Egypt, the slavery in Egypt, and the leaving of Egypt. So on the one hand, you have a biblical statement of 400 years in slavery, and on the other hand, the genealogy suggests 3 or 4 generations. And this is true not only of Moses and his siblings, but it's true of other characters. Nachshon, for example, who was the brother-in-law of Aaron, is descended from Judah, another one of Jacob's sons, 5 generations away. Zelophehad, a man mentioned in the book of Numbers, is again 5 generations removed from Joseph. And so the entire slavery must have occurred in about a 100-year period, because 3 or 4 generations is about a century, assuming 25 or so, perhaps 30 years per generation. Now, let me tell you a story that was related to me, which is very relevant here, by my teacher, Cyrus Gordon. Cyrus Gordon got involved in the field of biblical studies and archaeology quite early on in the 20th century. And in 1931, he made his first trip to Iraq to work in some excavations. And the scholars, they were mainly Americans and some British, hired the local villagers in northern Iraq to work on the excavation. And Gordon noticed, within a week or so, that among the workers was a father and son team, and the son was a very serious, judicious, earnest worker of great value to the excavation team. So one day at lunch, Gordon had already learned enough Arabic to speak the language. One day at lunch, he complimented the father on what a good son he had and what a good worker he was. And of course, the father thanked him. And making that kind of small talk as one does, the next question that came out of Gordon's mouth, as probably any American might ask, was, "How old is your son?" An innocent question. And the father responded, "By Allah, I do not know." That's a very common way in Arabic speech. "By Allah, I do not know. He may be 20, he may be 30, he may be 40. But you are a smart man, and you can figure out when he was born. He was born, you can figure out how old he is. He was born 1 year after the British occupied Iraq." Now, that happened in 1917, towards the end of World War I, as the Ottoman Empire was coming to an end. And that means the son was born in 1918. And that means in 1931, when this conversation took place, this young boy, this young man, was 13 years old, which is exactly what Gordon said. He looked like a young teenager. But when asked to provide an age for his son, the father did not know. And I repeat his words, "He may be 20, he may be 30, he may be 40. By Allah, I do not know." Using round numbers, using inflated numbers, and in fact, ending with the number 40. And I still use this in my classes today to teach my students. I was a student in Professor Gordon's class, and when we got to the passages in Genesis concerning the ages of the patriarchs and how was it possible for Abraham to be 100 and Sarah to be 90 at the birth of Isaac, he related this story to us, and it sticks with me to this day. We're talking here about people in the Near East who have been untouched by modernity. And one can still find such individuals in villages in northern Iraq, isolated in the mountains of that country, or in southern Egypt. This would not be true of Middle Easterners who've been exposed to the West in some fashion, people, educated individuals in downtown Cairo, or in Egypt, or in downtown Beirut, in Lebanon, many of whom can speak English and French, and therefore have learned the ways of thought that dominates our world as well, and probably can tell you how old they are or how old their children are. But in that world of these rural villages, you can still see how these individuals are unable to tell you how old they are or their children. At the same time, I have no doubt that this individual to whom Professor Gordon was speaking would have been able to recite his genealogy back, as I indicated, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 generations. And so when I'm faced with the biblical material that sits before me, and I say, so what am I going to do? Am I going to take these years, which do not accord with the genealogies, or do I take the genealogies? Because three or four generations can only be a century. It can't be 400 years. I take the latter route, because that is consistent with the Near Eastern custom of preserving very accurately family lineages, but not taking account of how old a particular individual is or how many years have passed from point A on a timeline to point B. Therefore, if Moses and the contemporaries of the Exodus lived around 1200 BCE and the slavery was about 100 years only, that puts Joseph in around 1300 BCE. He, in turn, is the great-grandson of Abraham, and again, using 25 to 30 years per generation, that brings Abraham back to about 1400 BCE. And even if we assume that, yes, Abraham was older than the average dad when Isaac was born, still it doesn't put us back nearly as far back as something like 1600, 1800, or 2000. That is how I, and those scholars who would take this route as well, date Abraham to 1400 BCE. Approximately. A second question that scholars ask is, where is Abraham's Ur? To which city does Ur of the Chaldees refer to? Now, one view proposes the great Sumerian city of Ur in southern Mesopotamia. Let's talk about that city. It was a major metropolis in the ancient world. The Sumerians were the first literate people in Mesopotamia, and probably the first literate people in the world, and they created a great civilization with major metropolitan centers, urban centers, of which Ur is probably the most famous. Now, the city was not known to scholars until the early part of the 20th century, when a British archaeologist named Sir Leonard Woolley went to excavate the place. And there he uncovered the great grandeur, lots of gold, remarkable architecture, including a ziggurat, in the city of Ur, and literally thousands of cuneiform documents telling us about the history, culture, economics, and so on of the city of Ur. And Woolley announced to the world that he had found the birthplace of Abraham. This was around 1920, and in fact published a book called Ur of the Chaldees. But there wasn't a single shred of evidence in all that documentation that we have at Ur in southern Iraq that indeed this was the birthplace of Abraham. But Woolley, because he was such a well-known archaeologist, and he eventually was knighted, Sir Leonard Woolley, convinced the world that he had found the birthplace of Abraham. The idea being that the founder of the monotheistic tradition, held sacred to Jews, Christians, and Muslims alike, could only have come from a city such as Ur in southern Iraq. What did scholars believe before Woolley did his excavations at Ur? A second view believes that Ur, from which Abraham came, is to be found in northern Mesopotamia, specifically the city of Urfa, it's still called that to this day, in southern Turkey, and as you can see from the first syllable of that name, retains the name Ur from ancient times. In the 19th century, before the rise of archaeology, the local tradition among the peoples of Ur, Jews, Muslims, and Christians, of Urfa, was that this was the birthplace of Abraham. Indeed, as you drive into the city of Orpha to this day, there is a sign, "Welcome to Orpha, birthplace of Abraham." Now, the people have no recognition, no idea about the scholarly debate. They simply hold it as a tradition, and we know that this tradition goes back into the Middle Ages and probably further back than that. Now, not every local tradition can be said to be accurate, but in this case, there is a lot of biblical evidence which points to the correctness of this identification. A couple of points can be raised in that regard. First, Joshua chapter 24 states that Abraham came from beyond the Euphrates. Now, this works for the location of Orpha in northern Mesopotamia, southern Turkey, but it does not work for Ur in southern Mesopotamia, modern-day southern Iraq, because that city of Ur is actually on the Euphrates. And to be pedantic, it is on the western shore of the Euphrates River, so that when you went from Ur to Canaan, you wouldn't even have to cross the Euphrates. Orpha in the north, however, is beyond the Euphrates, and that is where Abraham came from, in my estimation. It's consistent with the statement in Joshua 24. Secondly, we're told in Genesis chapter 11 that when Terah and Abram and Sarai and Lot set off on their journey from Ur to Canaan, they stopped in the city of Haran. And that is where Terah died, and it was from there that Abraham continued onward in chapter 12 from Haran to go on to the land of Canaan. Now, if you were to go from Ur in southern Iraq to Canaan, you would never go through Haran. It is simply not on the way. But if you began in this northern Ur, you would indeed go through Haran on your way to Canaan. The geography makes sense once more. And I note that all scholars agree on the location of Haran. There's no question about that. There's still a city to by that name, a relatively large city, in southern Turkey near the border with Syria. So as you would go from this Orpha to Canaan, you would indeed pass through Haran. That would not work, however, for the southern location of Ur that's been proposed. A third point. As two later chapters in Genesis show, chapters 24 and 29, when people from Abraham's inner circle, and I have in mind here his servant in Genesis 24 and his grandson, Jacob, return to the family homeland, where do they go to visit the relatives who did not journey onward? They go to the region of Aram in northern Mesopotamia. They do not go to southern Mesopotamia. So when you bring all of this information together and you add to it the local tradition that I've referred to among the Jews, Muslims, and Christians of Orpha in southern Turkey, this is to be the birthplace of Abraham. I should note that most likely this northern location of Ur is indeed related in some fashion to the southern location of Ur. That is to say, the great urban center of Ur in Sumer had colonies throughout the Near East, and probably the northern Ur was established as such a colony of the great city of southern Ur, an outpost, a trading outpost, a commercial venture of some sort. Let's use an analogy. London, the great city of London in England, and London, Ontario. We know, of course, that London, Ontario must have been founded by people who came from London, England. But let's make one further point on that. If I just said London, you would think, correctly, that I was referring to London, England. If I have to refer to a second London, I have to add another term, and I will indeed say London, Ontario. And that's why the Bible, to my mind, says Ur of the Chaldees or Ur of the Chaldeans. Because if you just said Ur, people would know that you're talking about the great Ur, the one in the south. By having to add that term, that expression, Ur of the Chaldees, Ur of the Chaldeans, the Hebrew expression is Ur Kasdim, that tells us that we're talking about a lesser-known Ur that has to be identified in some way. And finally, to point out that the ancient Greek historian and geographer Xenophon informs us in one of his works that the Chaldeans were neighbors of the Armenians, that is to say, in modern-day Turkey. And that works once more by placing the birthplace of Abraham, Ur of the Chaldees, using this information from Xenophon, in Orpha in southern Turkey. Once we realize that Abraham came from northern Mesopotamia, we next can explain why several customs attested among the Horians are reflected in the book of Genesis. Now, I mentioned the Horians before in an earlier lecture. Let's talk about them. The peoples of Mesopotamia, working from south to north, were the Sumerians, Babylonians, Assyrians, and Horians. They're in the far north, in the northern parts of the Tigris and Euphrates River Valley. Now, the Horians are known to us from a number of sites, but the most important Horian city is a city called Nuzi in northern Mesopotamia. It is extremely close, within a kilometer or so, of the modern city of Kirkuk in northern Iraq, in Kurdish territory. The city of Nuzi, the heyday of Nuzi, was the 14th century BCE, the time of the patriarchs, according to our dating, and the city of Nuzi yielded several thousand very important cuneiform tablets, written in the Babylonian language, although with lots of Horian words in them, no surprise given the fact that it was a population of Horians. These tablets give us the legal and socioeconomic practices of that city at that time. And we learn two things, two different practices which illuminate for us customs in the book of Genesis, which we mentioned in the previous lecture and which we now can go into in greater detail. There are, from Nuzi, a series of adoption tablets. These are cuneiform tablets, and they tell us about how men would adopt sons. Why did men do this? These were childless men, apparently, and they needed an heir, and so they would adopt their servants to be their heirs. This explains the relationship between Abraham and Eliezer in chapter 15. You'll recall that Abraham says to God that my servant Eliezer will be my heir. Well, how is it possible for a servant to be one's heir? We've all heard of stories of wealthy individuals leaving their gold watch, perhaps to their trusted butler, but that's about as far as we would go in our culture. But in ancient Nuzi, men indeed adopted their servants, if they were childless, to be their heirs. Now, why would a man do this? Because it was important to have a son. You needed somebody to take care of you in your old age. When you died, the funeral rituals had to be undertaken by your son. And then all sorts of other relationships between father and son were necessary. Why would a man like Eliezer or any other such individual from Nuzi enter into such a contractual arrangement? Probably because this person came from a poorer family, a less well-off family, perhaps lower middle class, perhaps even lower class, and this was a way of gaining an inheritance somewhere down the road when the man you served would pass away. And so it worked for both parties, for the adoptive father and the adopted son. And so we assume that underlying Genesis 15 is a relationship of this ilk. These adoption contracts furthermore state that if a natural-born son is born, the natural-born son will supersede the adopted son. And that is indeed what happens in the story in Genesis when God says to Abraham, no, that one, meaning Eliezer, will not be your heir, but he who issues forth from you, your natural-born son, will be. We also have marriage contracts from Nuzi, as we indicated in the previous lecture. And it states in these marriage contracts that if a woman is unable to conceive, it is her legal duty to present to her husband one of her slave women, handmaidens, as a second wife. And this explains why Sarah presents Hagar to Abraham in Genesis 16. And note, if you look at that story, that it is Sarah who takes the initiative here. Abraham doesn't make this suggestion. Sarah does. It is her legal responsibility to act. Again, underneath the pages of the Bible, in this case Genesis 16, is a legal tradition which tells us what the marriage relationship was between Abraham and Sarah, what their marriage contract would have looked like with such a clause built into it. And Sarah gives Hagar to Abraham, and that's how Ishmael comes to be born. I also mentioned Ugarit. Ugarit is a city in far northern Canaan, modern-day northwestern Syria on the Mediterranean coast. It flourished also in the 14th century and into the 13th century, the time we are talking about. And we have literary texts from Ugarit. Two epics, the Epic of Akkad, which concerns the hero Danael, a legendary king of Canaan, and his quest for a son. He is childless, and it culminates in the birth of the heroic lad Akkad. We have a second story called the Epic of Crete, about a legendary king as well, devoid of family. And this piece of literature, this composition, has a similar theme too. These two Canaanite stories demonstrate that the childless hero's quest for a son was a popular motif in antiquity, and this is built into the story of Abraham as well. The combined evidence of Ugarit and Nuzi, presented here in this lecture, suggests that the 14th century, during which both Nuzi and Ugarit flourished, is the most likely time period when Abraham lived.